Please open your Bibles to 2 Chronicles chapter 27, where we're going to get started in just one moment. First, I need to let you know that there are some chronological puzzles that pop up during the time period that we're looking at right now, where the descriptors of when certain kings started their reign indicate some overlap between certain kings that's not clearly explained in the text itself. Some of it makes good sense based on events that are happening around that same time, but we can't be dogmatic that that's exactly what happened. For example, it appears as if Jotham, the king that we're going to start talking about today, began to rule as an associate with his father, Uzziah, way back in 749 BC. So he was basically the crown prince from that year. And so his reign seems to be counted from that year. Then, just a few years later, in 741 BC, when Uzziah makes that horrible choice to try to offer incense inside of the temple, and he breaks out with leprosy, Jotham then begins functioning fully as the king of Judah, because his dad is having to isolate in a house by himself because of his leprosy. It appears as if that same year that the son of Jotham, a man by the name of Ahaz, that we're also going to talk about today, started counting his reign from that year. So he probably was declared the crown prince underneath his father because of his grandfather's disability. Well, when Uzziah dies, and remember that's the year that Isaiah begins reigning, Jotham is once again highlighted as the sole king of southern Judah, but he seems to have his son Ahaz working with him, associating with him in the kingdom work. And that, I believe, sets up a scenario where Ahaz eventually thinks that he should take over from his father and push his father to the side, maybe even imprisons him. Even though the text doesn't say it anywhere, Jotham seems to disappear from active rule after his 16th year on the throne, but his 20th year is mentioned later. So he's still alive, but evidently Ahaz is the one that's exercising control. So my suspicion is that the evil heart of Ahaz overwhelms the righteous rule of his father Jotham, and he seizes control. So let's talk about that from the text itself. So chapter 27 first has a couple of verses describing Jotham and how when he came to power. Verse 2 says he did what was right in the eyes of he who is, according to all that his father Uzziah had done, except he did not enter the temple of he who is, but the people still followed corrupt practices. So Jotham's reign, which we're talking about the 730s BC, is characterized by righteous rule on his part, but some unrighteous practices on the part of the people. And that's one of the reasons why Judah is going to suffer some damage from the Assyrian invasion, the judgment of God by that. Let's talk a little bit about what Jotham was doing when he was king. Verse number 3 says, he built the upper gate of the house of he who is and did much building on the wall of Ophel. The upper gate, not totally sure where this gate is at. Some have suggested that it is the high gate, which is the actual literal wording here, the high decorative gate that joined the palace complex on the south with the temple complex on the north. And I think that makes really good sense, that he would make that as a very special decorative place. The Ophel, again, some disagreement on exactly where this is at, but I believe that it's likely to be the little wall, semicircular stone wall that can now be seen in the archaeological ruins of the city of David on the east side of what was apparently a palace complex in the old city of Jerusalem. And so this is not up on the Temple Mount, but just a little bit south of there. And so he seems to be not just simply taking care of the newer part of Jerusalem, but also the older part. Verse 4, moreover, he built cities in the hill country of Judah and forts and towers in the wooded hills. So he's trying to protect his kingdom from some of the concerns that are coming up at this time in the later 8th century of turmoil amongst the nations of the Middle East. Verse number 5, he fought with the king of the Ammonites and prevailed against them. Judah does not share any borders with Ammonites, technically. The Ammonites are on the eastern side of the eastern portion of northern Israel. That is, across the Jordan from Jericho, and then several miles eastward from that is the closest border of Ammon with Judah. However, we have had historical records of that already, that the Ammonites have crossed down into the Jordan Valley and past Jericho and up into Judea proper and caused trouble. So apparently Jotham decided to fight with the Ammonites for doing that sort of stuff, and he wins. And so the Ammonites end up having to be tributary to Jotham. So they gave him that year 100 talents of silver. That's about 3.25 tons of silver. Buying power today would be something like tens of millions of dollars. So they gave that to him in silver, and 10,000 cores of wheat. That's about 60,000 bushels of wheat grain, or about 1,800 tons, and 10,000 of barley. Barley weighs a little bit less per bushel than wheat, so we're talking about 1,440 tons. So a lot of grain was paid, and it wasn't just that year. It was also the next 2 years. It says the Ammonites paid him the same amount in the second and third years. So Jotham became mighty because he ordered his ways before he who is his God. So Jotham is doing a good job, but right there close to him is his son Ahaz, who is apparently crown prince already, but who wants more. And so evidently, he shoves his father to the side for about 4 years of Jotham's life, from about his 16th year of reign, counted from when he became crown prince himself, until his 20th year of reign. And that's described in 1 Kings chapter 16. It says, in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. So it's not because his dad died, it's just because he seizes control. Verse 2, Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the eyes of he who is his God, as his father David had done, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. So even though his grandfather Uzziah was a good, righteous man, and even though his father Jotham was a good, righteous man, young Ahaz has made the free will choice to be more like the people of northern Israel. He has apparently adopted their worship styles, their worship regimens. And that is why he is a wicked, evil man. And it's probably also why he had no qualms about shoving his good father off to the side in order to take control of the kingdom for himself. So this is what he also did. Verse 3, he even burned his son as an offering according to the despicable practices of the nations whom he who is drove out before the people of Israel. That's a description of the Chemosh Molech worship that started first with the Moabites and the Ammonites, but also spread into the Canaanites. And it's a twisted connection to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, where God brought fire down on that region and destroyed it. And the people that escaped, the only people that escaped from that was Lot and his two daughters. And he was trying to hide out in a cave, and his two daughters decided that they needed to raise families, and the only man around was their dad. So they got him drunk, got pregnant by him. And that's where the Moabite and the Ammonite races come from. Moab is actually the word from daddy. And Ammon was the way of saying, this is the son of my family, the son of my people. So they kind of celebrated this incestuous beginning of their nation. And they even tied it into their religion. They counted God as this destroyer God, this destroyer king that needed to be appeased by getting drunk and intentionally getting pregnant and then offering to this God during the subsequent ceremonies of worship to him those intentional drunken pregnancies by burning them up as sacrificial babies. And then apparently archaeological evidence indicates that they would take the little charred bodies, stuff them into clay jars, and put them next to the foundations of their buildings as good luck talismans. Very sick practice. And yet here is King Ahaz, young King Ahaz, doing exactly that, offering one of his sons from a drunken worship ceremony as a sacrifice. But he didn't just do that. Verse 4, it says, he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. So he was also engaging in all the pagan worship too. Worship of Baal, worship of Asherah. And that is why he is such a wicked, wicked man. And Isaiah comes to him with a warning. And so let's go to Isaiah chapter number 7. Isaiah chapter number 7, where verse 1, it tells us this. In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not yet mount an attack against it. And this is what I am going to suggest to you happened. That when young Ahaz kind of took over from his father, Jotham, shoved him off to the side, this became a problem for the kingdom of northern Israel. They saw this as a bad thing. And so they decided they needed to invade Judah and get rid of this new upstart king, this Ahaz character. And King Pekah of Israel decided he needed to have some assistance in doing this. So he reaches out to his near neighbor, which is Rezin, the king of Syria at Damascus, and says, help me out here. Let's go down and get rid of this King Ahaz upstart and put somebody else in charge of that nation that will be an ally to us. And so Ahaz is immediately terrified by what's happening to his north. That is, this mobilizing of Israeli and Syrian forces to come against him. And the first thing that comes to his mind is that he's going to reach out to the Assyrians, even farther to the north, to Tiglath-Pileser III, and ask him to help him out. And so Isaiah comes to Ahaz at this point and tells him that that is not proper thinking. All right, let's go ahead and read. Isaiah chapter 7, verse number 2. When the house of David was told, Syria is in league with Ephraim, that is, Damascus, Syria, ruled over by Rezin, is making an alliance with Ephraim, otherwise known as Northern Israel, under the leadership of Pekah. So he's finding out about this mobilization. The heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. He who is said to Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz, you and Shir-Yashub, your son. Now, Isaiah is naming his kids very specific names at God's command, because these names mean something. Shir-Yashub in Hebrew means a remnant shall return. So God's already been prophesying that judgment is coming both on northern Israel and southern Judah eventually. And there'll be great death, destruction, and exile. But eventually, after repentance, after a timeout period, a righteous remnant will be brought back. So that's the name of Isaiah's boy. Remnant shall return. So he's supposed to take his son and meet King Ahaz at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the washer's field. Now, exactly where this is at, we don't know for sure. But it is somewhere that Ahaz is going to be involved in some public business. And he is going to talk to Ahaz there. And this is what he's supposed to say to him. Verse 4. Be careful. Be quiet. Do not fear. Do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands, at the fierce anger of Rezin of Syria and the son of Remaliah. So don't be afraid of these two smoking torches, because Syria with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah have devised evil against you, saying, let's go up against Judah and terrify it, and let us conquer it for ourselves and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. So that's what I was just talking about, is their plot, their intention, is to invade Judah, get rid of Ahaz, and replace him with somebody that will be allied to them. And so Ahaz is being told by Isaiah, don't be afraid of what is being threatened against you. Verse 7, thus says he who is God, it shall not stand, it shall not come to pass, for the head of Syria is Damascus, the head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken to pieces so that it will no longer be a people. So here we have a very specific time limit put on the northern kingdom. They are going to be totally gone from the historical stage 65 years from now. Now, why pick that particular date? I don't know. Just enough to let him know that he doesn't need to worry about these two upstarts. Verse number 9. The head of Ephraim is Samaria. The head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. So he's got to trust God instead of this thing that's already in his head of putting his trust in Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser III. Again, he who has spoke to Ahaz. Now, you're going to, if you've never seen this before, you're going to be puzzled a little bit by this because we're about to hear things that we hear at Christmas time all the time. But it's because there's a double meaning, a double prophecy happening here in this passage. God is capable of doing that because he knows the future and the past as if they're the present. He is outside of time. So he is able to apply things to both close in time events and distant in time events. So he spoke to Ahaz, ask a sign of he who is your God, let it be as deep as Sheol or high as heaven. So Isaiah told Ahaz, you can ask God for any sign you want to prove to you that he will protect you from these invaders. Just name it, and God will do it for you. Because God is trying to raise up faith in this young Ahaz. But Ahaz is having nothing to that. Ahaz said, I will not ask, I will not put he who is to the test. Now that's an excuse. It's couched in religious terms. But it is an excuse that he really doesn't want to talk to God about anything. His heart is elsewhere. So Isaiah, at God's command, gives him a prophecy anyway. He said, hear then, O house of David. Is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also? So why are you putting God to the test by refusing to ask him for proof that he can be trusted? Therefore, verse 14, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, which is Hebrew for El, God, is with us. So God is on our side. Now, we are of the habit of thinking of this as part of the Christmas story, because it is. Because a virgin did conceive and give birth to a son who had the right to the title God is with us. Literally, God is in our presence. But that's the later prophecy. That's the distant one in the book of Isaiah. The closer one is something about to happen in the 8th century BC. Something that involves Isaiah himself getting remarried, because he's already been married once, probably widowed, and his currently virgin fiance, once he marries her, is going to get pregnant and give birth to a son. Verse 15, he shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse evil and choose good. So he's going to grow up and start eating solid food on his own, and he's going to be able to start thinking well enough to choose what is right and wrong. So we're talking about toddler, preschool, early elementary age. And then comes this, verse 16. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. So before Isaiah's not yet conceived son is in preschool or early elementary school, before he's that age, Ephraim, that is northern Israel, and Damascus, Syria, will have been whacked by God's judgment, and they will no longer be a threat. That's the prophecy. That's the close-in prophecy. Now, we love the Jesus prophecy, and I think we should always revel in it when we're thinking about the ultimate fulfillment of this, but let's not miss out on the closer-in prophecy. Verse 17, he who is will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as has not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria. Now, when we're looking at this, it's just a little over 200 years since Israel, northern Israel, split away from southern Judah. And the prophecy of Isaiah is, you are about to see something happen in the Middle East that is nothing like's happened in the last 200 years. And that is Tiglath-Pileser III sweeping through the land. And then after him, Shalmaneser. This is all about the fulfillment of God's judgment that we saw back in the book of Amos as well, by bringing the Assyrians through the land. In that day, verse 18 says, the Lord, or he who is, will whistle for the fly that is at the end of the streams of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. So Egypt's also going to get involved in all the fighting that's going to be going on soon. And they will all come and settle on the steep ravines and in the clefts of the rocks and on all the thorn bushes and on all the pastures. So there's going to be a lot of activity going on in the Middle East right around northern Israel. In that day, he who is will shave with a razor that is hired beyond the river with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the feet, and it will sweep away the beard also. That's judgment talk about being captured and processed as a slave, having your head shaved. You know, it's probably an anti-lice device. But that's all going to soon come to pass at the hands of Tiglath-Pileser III when he sweeps into the land. And guess who's going to be inviting him? This man, Ahaz, that should have known better and should have trusted God instead.